Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Drs. Scott Marion and Derek Briggs. Scott is the Executive Director of the Center for Assessment and a new member of the National Assessment Governing Board. Derek is a professor in the Research and Evaluation Methodology Program in the School of Education at the University of Colorado Boulder. He is also the current president of the National Council on Measurement in Education and the author of the new book, Historical and Conceptual Foundations of Measurement in the Human Sciences, Credos and Controversies. Thank you both for being on the podcast. I want to start by asking you about the Biden administration's decision to require testing during the 2020-2021 school year. At the time, what were the immediate concerns about requiring testing, and what did the federal government do to try to alleviate these concerns?
I think the immediate concerns were that there would be some states for which this would be a particularly onerous burden, in particular across the country. As we know, we're still in the midst of the pandemic. Some states were better equipped to come back and bring students in for in-person learning experiences, but in other states that was much more spotty. And so there was a real question about the burden this would place in having students return to school for testing. Some of the concerns that I think Scott and I expressed at the time was that, you know, this would potentially not be the ideal use of educational time for students to come back and sit for tests when they'd been removed and had not had access to in-person instruction for some time, to have them immediately come back to school, only to be sitting for testing might not be the best use of educational time. So it's a mix of things. It's one, there's sort of a question of the capacity in different states to actually do in-person testing. And secondly, there's sort of a question about the value proposition for students returning to school, and instead of having more contact time with teachers, to spend that time testing. So I'd say those were two major concerns.
And I would just add one more, is that related to these, we were worried that in terms of this value proposition, would the noise, if you will, the statistical noise, the uncertainty associated with test results be so large that it would blur out any potential thing we might learn or signal from the tests? So those are the three, I think, major concerns.
How do you feel that the federal government did in terms of alleviating any of those concerns?
They were not as flexible as some states needed, but they, you know, Washington, D.C., that had 90% or more of their kids remote for almost the whole year, got a quote-unquote waiver from testing in spring 21. Certain states like New Jersey and some others asked to have to move their testing to the fall, and they changed up the type of test they give, and they were granted permission. Colorado, where you guys are, was able to do a sampling type approach. So there was some flexibility, not as much as some states wanted, but more than nothing.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. I mean, the part, you know, there was some sort of kind of an olive branch held out, which that they would have some flexibility, but there were real limits on the flexibility. And the Colorado example is sort of a really good one, because that Colorado is in some sense maybe one of the more creative approaches. And that, you know, when Scott says it was sampling, it was not maybe sampling the way you might think. It's not that they sampled students, but they essentially toggled, you know, between subject matters. So they would have one grade you would test in mathematics, but not in ELA, and the next English language arts, that is. And then the next grade, students would be tested in English language arts, but not mathematics. And at the time when they submitted that, the federal government had not been granting many waivers for other approaches that were sort of creative in that way. So I think I and others was surprised, actually, that they granted that for Colorado. But, you know, they did allow a waiver in a case like DC, where, you know, they could make the argument that 90% of students wouldn't be able to come back in person. But there are other states where it was almost, you know, as onerous. And certainly New York was a really good example, where there was pretty clear indication that they were likely to only have maybe half of students in the state. And that turned out to be true. And they were not granted a waiver.
You've already started to mention how the experience varied across states, but if you were recommending how test results should be used and reported to a policymaker, what would you tell them?
Yeah, what we tell people is, first, talk about participation, or first, talk about enrollment, mm-hmm. right? We've seen a lot of reports on the trends in enrollment. So how many kids fewer are enrolled. This has been for last year compared to 2019, right? And then talk about participation rate before you ever start talking about any test scores. And so people don't always like hearing it in that order. They want to get right to the scores, but you have to force them to understand that changes from what's typically 95 to 99% participation down to, in many cases, 70, 80, 85%. It doesn't sound that bad to folks who aren't in this world, but as I always say, so what if that meant that none of your special ed or EL kids were tested? Oh, that would be a big deal. Well, that would get you down to, 80%. And so pretty quickly. So that's how people have to understand it. So that's the first thing you need to do. And then to recognize, think about like which kids were missing. Where is it likely your highest performing kids or your lowest performing kids? Do you have any sense of that? And once you have some understanding of that, it helps you interpret the results appropriately or more appropriately.
I'd like to shift our conversation a little bit. So far, we've been talking about how state results should be used, but in the last few months, there's been some discussion about the recent release of NAEP results. Let me start with asking you about NAEP itself. So what is it and how is it different from state tests?
So NAEP has been around since the early 60s, and it's meant to measure and to monitor educational trends in the United States. And it's meant to be sort of this stable indicator that goes across some of the instability and unstability of state educational regimes, whether it be testing or curriculum or standards. And so the idea is that, it's the old saying comes from NAEP, Al Beaton, if you want to measure change, don't change the measure. And so, and unfortunately, it was learned with NAEP as well. But the point is that the goal of NAEP is to provide a stable indicator of educational trends and educational progress in the United States. It started in the early 60s, and it's based on a sample of kids across the United States. That's what we call the national NAEP. In the early 90s, what was started was called state NAEP. So there was not just a national sample. There was samples of kids in fourth and eighth grade within each state, so that each state would get an indication of their performance relative to the national picture, relative to other states, relative to their own progress. And the state NAEP has certainly become the more prominent view. The results that were just released that we've talked about offline are national NAEP trends, the large scale study. So there's two versions of NAEP. There's the long-term trend NAEP, and then there's the state NAEP, which really been around since early 1990s. And so that's a pretty long-term trend as well. And so those are the two versions. And they're meant to be different than state tests. First of all, they only sample a portion of the students. Each student only takes a portion of the content. And so it's very inobtrusive. It takes 90 minutes or so for a kid to test. And then the state gets a pretty good picture of how their kids performed on the full set of NAEP questions, if you will, and get a sense of their performance, again, relative to how they performed previously as a state and relative to other states.
I think the other thing that's really important people to appreciate about NAEP and why it's considered, I think rightfully so, it's really a gold standard. And to the extent that you're doing standardized testing, NAEP really is a gold standard, not just because of it's much less of a burden on students than state level testing, but also because of the care that's taken. There are so many levels of oversight in some sense and with how NAEP is created. There is a design analysis committee of experts that weigh in. There's really some fantastic people at Educational Testing Service that are contracted to do the work. They work with the design analysis committee to think through technical issues. There's also, of course, the National Assessment Governing Board that Scott is a part of, that really leads and guides what how NAEP proceeds. And there is also another important entity, an entity called NAEP Validity Studies that takes on essentially questions of, hey, are you concerned about whether we can really trust particular inference based on NAEP? Or are there other things we need to be looking into about how NAEP is used? They're constantly churning out studies to examine different issues in view of improving the system. So it's really pretty remarkable just how the NAEP as a product involves so many different entities and the care with which it's done.
Now let me ask you about the most recent release of NAEP. So the recent release shows a decline in multiple subjects that dates back to 2009. I know it's always hard to know exactly why this is happening, but what do we know about what is happening? For example, is this a decline being experienced by all students, or is this a decline that's concentrated in a specific subgroup?
I mean, I think that, it is what we're seeing is a mixture of sort of decline and sort of stagnation, I guess. Sort of a best case scenario is you're seeing, I think particular in reading, you're just seeing really no movement at all. In mathematics, we're seeing some evidence of an overall slight decline. It's not at all what we would have expected or wanted to see based on the kind of work that was being done at the federal level to provide incentives and sort of test-based accountability. We would want to see some at least slight increases. And there's some sense in which that which is most sensitive to instruction, mathematics tends to be a little bit more sensitive to instruction than does reading. And so we would have, if anything, expected to see math pick this up. And instead, we're seeing actually the opposite. And I think more worrisome from an equity standpoint is that what we're seeing actually is if you break this down to students who in 2009 were scoring in the lowest percentile, the distribution, say in the 10th percentile, versus students that were scoring, say, in the 90th percentile of the distribution. If you look at the performance of students 10 years later that are also in the 10th percentile and the 90th percentile, what you're seeing is those students that were in the 90th percentile are now scoring much worse. And the students that are scoring in the 90th percentile, that's where we do see a slight increase. So to the extent that there were gaps 10 years ago, what this is suggesting is those are actually widening. And that's a real worrisome sign. So this is really, one might argue that from a perspective of what happened during the 2010s, this is the story that we're seeing a widening of inequality. And that's sort of the reason why something like NAEP exists, to be able to shine a light on this sort of a story. So it's absolutely something we need to pay close attention to.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. I think that what Derek talked about is the key message. We've seen a widening of income inequality over the same time and been going on for a while. It's not surprising that we see it reflected in the achievement scores of kids who are subject to those disparities in income. And people are always good at coming up with stories to explain data after they see the data, right? Henry Brown talks about these just so stories. Nobody was positing these stories beforehand, but I've seen some really interesting, so of course the anti-Common Core folks will rush to blame the Common Core. There's little evidence that that's the cause. I saw an interesting supposition from Mike Petrelli, who I disagree with probably 80% of the time, but he said that, the education spending really dipped in this country post the 2008-2009 Great Recession. And it took years until it came back. And he made the case that hurt a lot of kids. And I think if education spending gets cut, who's it going to hurt the most? The kids who need the most. So again, it would have been better to have that story come out first before we saw the results as a hypothesis than to try to explain it. But I think we have to look broadly. The people who will rush to assume it's the Common Core or the NGSS or something else, I think they're just looking for easy explanations to support their causes. But I do think we do know it mirrors the kind of income gaps, growing income inequality in this country. It's not surprising we see this.
Yeah, and just to add one more thing onto that is, you know, what Scott's saying is exactly right. Like NAEP is not designed to estimate causal effects. It's meant to sort of give you a reason for trying to speculate about changes. So, you know, you have NAEP to monitor what's going on in the system. And when you notice changes in one direction or the other, it's a natural tendency, both of policymakers, researchers, lay people alike, when you notice a change, you're going to want to say, well, why did it change? And so that's good. That's why NAEP exists, to get people speculating about possible causes. But so I think what we're going to start seeing is a lot of people now trying to figure out whether cause A versus cause B is the more likely explanation for what we're seeing. But everything needs to be put on the table. So I side with Scott in thinking that a more likely explanation for what we're seeing has to do with issues of wealth inequality, income inequality, all kinds of disparities in sort of the network of resources that students have access to, I think is really the most likely cause for the sorts of things that we're seeing. That we have to remember that education can only play so much of a role. It's an important role, but it's not the only role. However, we have to entertain the possibility that the sorts of things that are being done in terms of curriculum are not working as well as we'd like them to be working. We have to entertain the possibility that test-based accountability, the theory of action for that, needs to be revisited. It may not actually be having the effects we think it's having. So these things need to be put on the table. But of course, we can't ascertain one from the other from the results of NAEP, but they certainly suggest that in a correlational sense, things are not heading in the direction we would have anticipated.
You know, one thing to make clear is this is a case where you definitely don't want to shoot the messenger. You want to see where people want to blame the test. And man, that's the last thing I would do.
I'd like to conclude by asking you about lessons learned. One of the things that I've been asking scholars is whether there are practices that we tried during the pandemic that we'd like to continue after the pandemic is over. For example, when the pandemic started, there was an effort across the country by school district leaders to ascertain what the needs of their students were outside of schools, things like whether they needed food or housing or clothing or Wi-Fi. So are there lessons that we learned about testing that we'd like to carry on after the pandemic is over?
Yeah, absolutely. I was part of a sort of collection of people pushing hard for opportunity to learn data. At what you're talking about, Chris, at one level, you know, like sort of Maslow's lowest level hierarchy, right? Food, you know, shelter, things like that, very important. But things like bandwidth and devices and, you know, moving up the level. But then you start talking about instructional practices. And so many of us, I think it was Derek in a technical advisory committee meeting, we were proposing some opportunity to learn data collection. He said, well, this is what we should be doing every year. And back in the day, we used to do this kind of stuff. And so at a minimum, that's one thing that I think that we will carry forward. I think many states, I know many states, shortened their summative test and found out that, yeah, it's now that they shortened it, they're going to have a hard time convincing constituents that, oh no, now we need the longer test. So that's something that I think we'll carry forward as a shorter summative test. People could judge whether that's good or bad. It's probably overall good, except if it makes the test all multiple choice. But so those are just two things. I'll let Derek weigh in on other things.
You know, absolutely reaffirm what Scott said about one lesson that we've learned is the importance of gathering information, opportunity to learn is clearly something we need to be doing regularly. And one of the points I made is not just about, you know, we need to do this in times of a pandemic, but I think that we also emerged at a time where there was a sense of kind of a racial reckoning and sort of an attention to sort of issues of equity and social justice. And so one of the reasons for administering tests is to gain some insight into possible inequality and opportunity. Well, you need to have the indicators of opportunity to go along with the test results to actually investigate those sorts of things. So absolutely, that's one thing that we've learned. I think another thing though, that one thing that Scott didn't mention is I think people are recognizing now this won't be the last, unfortunately, you know, that we will probably experience disruptions like this in the future. I hope that they're rare. But even if it's not from pandemic, we could imagine other disruptions related to the changing environment. There could be all kinds of reasons why in various jurisdictions you're going to have disruptions in schooling and disruptions in the ability to test in person. So I think that one thing that people are becoming aware of is need to think about how could you do remote assessment and remote learning? And how can we get better at that, at being nimble and flexible when these kinds of disruptions occur, so that it doesn't catch us as much a surprise as it did in March of 2020, when it felt like the world was upside down. And so it took a lot for educators to adjust to a virtual environment, and also for those who are administering tests. How do you administer a remote proctored test? I think we've actually learned some things over the last year about how we might actually be able to do this. And if you think about NAEP again, NAEP is actually now thinking about how they can start being more flexible in the way they administer the test, because it's quite costly the way that NAEP administers the test right now. They send in people into school, in-person administration. You have to have people that are trained to do that. And it can pose a real health risk. And this is one reason why the decision was made not to test during the pandemic, even though it had been a scheduled testing period for NAEP. It imposed too great a risk on the contractors that were to go in person. You were literally going to be sending people into places where they could be infected, and that was unethical. In addition, the difficulty of actually reaching students posed serious logistical challenges. So NAEP is actually, as a program, thinking about, you know, how do we think about ways in which we could administer NAEP in a more remote way, in a more flexible way, so it could actually be administered just on whatever device students have available to them in their particular local setting. So that's another thing that I think is a lesson that we've learned, is that we're going to have to be more adaptable than we have in the past.
I agree. Yeah, I had characterized it. There would have been, if they would have tried to administer NAEP last year, it would have been, instead of Typhoid Mary, Typhoid NAEP administrators, you know, carrying the disease from school to school. And you know, speaking of NAEP, there is a fairly high stakes, not in an accountability sense, but in terms of an information sense, administration of NAEP coming up this winter, spring. 2022 NAEP, which is the one that got delayed, is a big deal, because this will be our first look. We have NAEP from right before the pandemic, and we'll have NAEP post now. Well, we wish it was post-pandemic, but still through the hardest part, I think. And so this is a really consequential look, and we've already been talking with NCES, National Center for Education Statistics, about, you know, how to think about the kinds of things we learned about analyzing these data, the kind of work that Derek and Andrew Ho and Damien Biedebenner and other colleagues here at the Center for Assessment have been working on, to try to help us really understand what these test scores mean in this context. So that's going to be pretty consequential, Nate. It won't be, you know, the results always take time to come out, but people, policymakers, are going to be looking at that. And I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't tell, you know, support the state test results, because that's one thing I will say. When I look across states, when I look at the interim assessments, I'm seeing a pretty consistent picture. Still plenty of variation, but the elevator speech hasn't changed that much. Sorry, Derek.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I want to come back to that, because I don't know that we fully touched on this enough. Yeah. I think that, there's this question about what should we be using the 2021 test results to do? And I want to come back to that and say that, you know, typically when we have those test results, we're typically trying to, in a very coarse way, get a sense of trend for states. And again, this tends to be very correlational. There are a lot of things happening from year to year in a state. And so when you notice changes from one year to the next, there are a lot of possible causes. This is one situation where, when you're comparing results, if you had the full population of students from 2019 to 2021, and you notice a change in the average performance, it's very hard to not think that the attribution should go to the pandemic, right? Especially when we suspect that evidence of learning that relative to third graders in 2009 compared to third graders in 2021, our best hypothesis is that those third graders in 2021 will not perform as well on the test because their learning has been disrupted. That's what we'd expect if we had all the information. Now, The big problem, of course, is that in most states, you don't have exactly the same population in 2019, but there are enough states where it's close, right? Where there's, yes, there was lower participation, but it's close that if you're very careful in how you do the analysis, you can at least get some sense, right, for the magnitude of the impact. And I just want to be clear, like, that's what we're after here. In this particular case, when people are presenting the results, it would be a real mistake just to present the 2021 observed results without doing some sort of an adjustment for the fact that there are differences in the population. And so I think states have been given at this point a lot of guidance for how they can do it. There are a lot of different analyses that have already been performed, but it's not across the board. And so I think that's one of the things that I worry about still, is that we're actually still just seeing the results from, even though it was back in spring 2021, not all states have presented all the information now that would permit an inference to be made about the impact of COVID on student learning. And a real worry that I have is that if you're not making an adjustment, what we've learned so far is that typically the students who did not test in 2021 tended to be students who were lower achieving in the past. So if anything, if you don't make an adjustment, you are getting an overly optimistic picture about the impact of the pandemic. What I mean by that is you're likely to conclude, you know what, it wasn't so bad. It really didn't seem to have that big an impact. It wasn't that disparate. And that's because you're missing the students that would really show you the larger impact. And so one of the reasons I objected to testing was exactly this, was that I thought, you know, if anything, we already sort of can anticipate what the impact of the pandemic was. The kids that did not have access to the same level of resources in the past, the kids that have been historically marginalized, minoritized students, these are the students that are going to be hit the hardest, right? And we, in some sense, did not need testing to show this. And if a test suggested the opposite, I think it would just lead to questions about the validity of the test, right? And so I think that's something we still need to grapple with going forward for the way that the results are being presented, is make sure that when states are presenting this information and when policymakers are evaluating the impacts, and using that to the extent that they are as a way to decide which schools and districts are getting access to greater resources for help going forward, that they aren't doing so based on the wrong information. And I think we need to be aware, like, we have a lot of catching up to do. Like, I mean, kids need help. I mean, there are kids that are behind. And the like, I already don't think enough was done over the last summer. And I think we need to be thinking, like, over the next 5 years, what are we doing, you know, in terms of providing additional resources and learning opportunities to make up for what's happened over, like, a year and a half that's just been a severe disruption.
And I think that you just mentioned, you just threw out 5 years, but I think that's the right time frame to be thinking about. Again, that's why we'll need the 22 results to look at. But we're asking for the kind of acceleration at scale that we have not been that good at doing at small scale, right? And so this is, we're asking for some fundamentally new things. I agree with Derek that lots of us predicted this was what would the results would be. The one thing that I will add, though, what I've seen, Derek, is when we have these data that we could present to state policymakers, they have a, oh, fill in the blank, you know, oh no, right? This is really bad. And then even though we cringe, folks like Derek and I cringe when we start converting these things into months of learning or years of learning, if you just sort of like give a little bit of that, it's big deal. This is like significant parts of a year or more of shortfalls, right? So the message that I'm saying to policymakers is, great, you have these ESSER funds, use them really wisely, but they're going to run out. The latest you could use them is September 24. We're not going to be done with this by September 24. So unlike what Mike Petrelli was talking about the loss of funding after the Great Recession, state policymakers need to pony up And Derek's right. There was not enough going on last summer, except in a few really high functioning districts. Teachers were burned out. I couldn't get teachers. I'm on my local school board. I couldn't get teachers to agree to do summer school. They just needed a break. I understand that. So we need to build the labor pool to be able to provide these additional services for kids going forward.
Thank you again, Scott and Derek, for being on this month's podcast. As always, thanks for listening. We hope that you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu or follow NEPC on Twitter @NEPCTweet.